You are Locked On Nets, your daily Brooklyn Nets podcast, part of the Locked On Podcast Network, your team every day.
And welcome into an in-person edition of the Locked On Nets podcast. Gavin Schall joined, as always, enjoying a piece of arugula, Josh Bass. Josh, how's it going?
This is actually babka, so it seems like you're confusing your Jewish pastries.
Oh, yeah. No, I'm not the expert you are. Anyways, we are getting into some Nets basketball. Not all bad news. They won their last game, but obviously in a big picture sense, it's a little bit of a doom and gloom right now after the D'Angelo Russell injury. He's out for an indefinite amount of time after undergoing arthroscopic surgery on his left knee this past Friday. The Nets did not give a timeline for his return. So, Josh, this is obviously pretty traumatic, especially in light of losing Jeremy Lin for the season. But the Nets have played with a little bit more of an edge since he went out.
Yeah, they're definitely playing hard. And we talked so far this season that the Nets play better with Spencer Dinwiddie at the helm. I don't think that's going to continue long term because Russell is their most talented player. And you have to hope that he can get back somewhat soon. I think Kevin Love had the same surgery last year, and he came back in about 6 weeks. And obviously, everyone recovers differently. But it definitely is concerning because D'Lo is one of the best players on the team. And also, he's had some trouble with his knees so far in his career. And if he's going to be the franchise player of the team, he needs to stay healthy because the Nets fans can't deal with any more injuries to point guards.
Yeah, he was averaging 20 points, 6 assists a game. And from what I understand about this injury, because we saw him get hurt, I think it was it in L.A. he got hurt?
I think it was the first Utah game.
Yeah, it was the first Utah game, you're right. But apparently, like, he was, like, dealing with knee issues for, like, a while. So he hasn't necessarily been at 100% for a good chunk of the season, which makes it all the more impressive, at least, like, the raw numbers. He's putting up about 21 points, 6 assists a night. But we've been saying time and time again, a lot of stuff he does and a lot of the way he plays. And keep in mind, this isn't, like, a long-term critique of Russell. It's just a lot of it is just the reality of, like, a young player who grew up maybe in a system that wasn't conducive to promoting him to share the basketball, at least in the right way. But a lot of what he was doing, I think we both felt, was somewhat counterproductive to the Nets and kind of hijacking possessions and taking over the offense and stalling things out when ball movement was really good. And we've seen that kind of improve over the course of these two games. I think there's a lot more cutting. And they've kind of gotten back to the way they were playing at the beginning of this season in terms of really looking for a great shot.
Yeah, I mean, it could be kind of a bump after missing your most talented player and your best player for a couple of games, but I don't think they can sustain that for a long period of time if he's out. I mean, I think we kind of see that often, like, team loses their top guy, has an improbable win. Everyone says, oh, maybe it's not going to hurt them that much, and then they just crater with a really long losing streak. And Nets are playing the Warriors tomorrow, so it definitely looks like it could be the start or something. They had a pretty easy schedule to start the year, but I'm worried that Spencer Dinwiddie's going to tire out with all the added responsibility now.
Yeah, absolutely. And a little Ewing theory action, I guess, on the Nets' part, or at least that's what we're suggesting could potentially happen. But the Nets going 1-1 over their last two games. And I guess I should start off with an apology. We didn't do a podcast this week up until now. And we were, what do we say, Josh, DNP personal?
Yeah, I was dealing with some personal stuff, but I'm ready to go right now. I was able to catch both of the last two games, so I'm excited to kind of get back into it with you, Gavin, and talk some Nets basketball because it's been a nice outlet for me during this trying time. So thank you for the listeners for sticking with us.
Yeah, we obviously really appreciate it. The Brooklyn Nets, two games back, falling to the Boston Celtics 109-102, but a lot of really encouraging signs in this one. They came out, were like a little bit sloppy in the first quarter, and then totally turned it around in the second, didn't play well in the third, and then finished the game really, really strongly. But the lineup was pretty interesting. It was Dinwiddie, Crabb, RHJ, Carroll, Booker to start off, and I think Booker gave them some good juice early on. He was like the one guy like scoring kind of consistently in the first quarter. And considering just how stifling the Celtics defense had been, like, keep in mind, like, what was it, like 3 days after this, they held the Warriors to 88 points. This was a really impressive offensive outing for the Nets. And again, it was kind of what we were hinting at when we were talking about the issues around D'Lo. All of them seemed to I don't want to say all of them, because that's overstating it, but it's to some degree, at least, they kind of evaporated without him. Like, the ball was pinging around the perimeter. And more importantly, when you don't have that fulcrum of your offense, or you only have one in Dinwiddie, and there's no one for him to really play off of in terms of an attacking player, that makes the need for guys moving off ball, it's not like just like an added benefit or like a nice supplemental part of the offense. That becomes your offense, and I think guys did a really good job of that.
Yeah, no, the ball movement definitely looked good, but at the same time, in the NBA, when it gets to crunch time and the games are close, it's always iso ball. You could have the Hawks of 3 years ago, and it's still iso ball when it gets to the end of games. It's just how it seems to go, because teams are afraid of turning the ball over and letting the other team get back in transition. So I'm worried that once we do get into those close games, there's not going to be that one-on-one creator there, because Russell is a very talented guy in those situations. He can get his shot off pretty much whenever, and there's no one else really on this Nets team that can even come close to that.
Yeah, for sure. Like, Dinwiddie will get guys sometimes, because he'll have that little pump fake. He'll hit a couple deep threes, which, like, I think it was the Jazz game, but he hit another one at the buzzer. And I think he might actually lead the NBA in those at the end of halves. He's just, especially if you take into account like shot clock expiring, he's like a knack for making those shots. But tangent. He's good at driving the basketball when he can get guys to take a step out, but he's not someone, when a defense is totally set, he's going to have really consistent success attacking the basket. You obviously look for continued development from Rondae Hollis-Jefferson, who was very sharp against the Celtics, 7-13 from the field, and someone like Caris LeVert maybe will get some reps in that spot, but there's not really a clear go-to guy. And as you hinted at, Josh, I think it's going to kind of come down to Kenny Atkinson's ability to draw plays in those situations and get guys free artificially, because you don't have that guy you can just throw it to and say, go get us two.
Yeah. What do you think of Mozgov getting benched the last two games? Only played 6 minutes against the Celtics, didn't get in the game at all against the Jazz. I think that's kind of been an underreported story here. I'm pretty happy about it, but I kind of want to know what you think.
No, I'm with you, and I think it's it might have happened anyways, like even if D'Lo was healthy. But I think as a response to that, it makes a lot of sense, because he's kind of a functional piece as a rim protector and a roller when you have D'Angelo Russell in, and you can kind of afford a little bit less spacing just because you have a guy who can create in chaos like D'Lo. When you lose that, you need to maximize every other guy's opportunity on the floor to have a chance to get to the basket and not face double teams, not face double teams every single time they crash, just because Mozgov's man could step right off on him and double the ball. So I think that's Kenny Atkinson's way of artificially kind of creating some of the space that D'Lo creates. So I think it makes a lot of sense with him out.
Yeah, and also I love Trevor Booker and his newly shaved head in the starting lineup. I feel like that's going to become a rallying cry for the Nets. Like, Trevor Booker's kind of weird head.
Hey, yeah, he's going to have to go to the barber every morning and keep shaving as long as this one-game winning streak lasts. But, yeah, I thought it was a nice effort against the Celtics. Did you have any other thoughts on that game? If not, I'm really fine going on to the Jazz, just because it's like they played well and they lost to a really good team.
Yeah, it was tough for the Nets to keep up with the Celtics. They just have too many smart players. They have Marcus Smart, and they have a lot of smart players also. So it's hard for the Nets to keep up, because a lot of the guys on the Nets are either limited athletically or don't have the greatest basketball IQ. So they did a good job kind of staying in the game. Alan Crabb, I thought, had a really nice performance, getting 3-point attempts off and making 5 of them. Just there wasn't enough juice for the Nets to pull out the win, but it was good to see Caris LeVert have a really good game, because he's been struggling a lot, and he struggled the next game against the Jazz, which we can get into right now.
Yeah, I thought it was pretty telling, because Sarah Kustak, who I feel weird like that I clarify this every time, but she's been really, really good. It was a very small critique of her. She was like talking about how like LeVert's been better recently, and then like the TV crew put up like a big graphic and they were showing his shooting percentages, and it was like first 6 games of the year, 38%, last 11 games, 35%. And it's just like, I get he's like maybe been like a little bit more aggressive, and he's made some plays on defense, but just in terms of putting the ball in the basket, he struggled until that Celtics game, 6-7 from the field in 22 minutes.
Well, he still looks like Steph Curry compared to Lonzo. Yeah. I hope LeVar doesn't take shots at me for that. But.
No, I know. No, they're going to be like, did you hear what Josh said about your son? And he's going to be like, who? Much like his response to Donald Trump. Yeah, so you're
don't let me in the same category as Trump, please.
Yeah. At least acknowledge that you exist. Yeah, the other guy that really impressed me is Joe Harris, 19 points in 20 minutes. And it was kind of telling, because this was, I thought this was a pretty good Alan Crabb game, as you pointed out, like at least he was able to get some shots up, but it took him 33 minutes to get to 15, and he was so quiet in the first quarter. It was another situation, and I find either he's taking a shot every possession or he's in for 6 minutes and I don't even notice that he's on the court. And Harris, it was just so apparent. He like missed his first like three or four threes, and they were all like really good looks, and it just is like, oh, it's not going to be his night. But the way I think it was Kustak, or it might have been Ian Eagle, who even was like referencing this. He was like hunting out his shots. You could tell Kenny Atkinson told him, he's like, hey, someone's got to step up with D'Lo out. And he was doing it. He was taking tough threes. He was taking contested threes. And he wasn't just settling for kickouts, which is kind of what he'd been doing. And you think of someone like at Joe Harris's talent level, I'm like, I don't want you doing that for any NBA team. I don't care what that team is, but he's clearly gotten a lot better, and he looked really good in that role. So I'm interested to see how sustainable that is.
Yeah, one thing to note about Harris, like when he comes off a screen, he's not just running it lazily, just because that's part of the set. He's always sprinting, prepared to shoot, and that's why he has great preparation. He does a good job of squaring himself in the air, and that's something that also the Nets broadcast has pointed out that Spencer Dinwiddie's really improved himself at. Just having more consistent mechanics off the dribble with it, your three-point shot is so key. And I think that's a big reason why Caris LeVert isn't that good of a shooter. But it just speaks to Joe Harris's preparation and why he's really turned himself into a solid bench piece this year. A guy who was in the D-League for most of a couple years ago with Cleveland Cavaliers. He's found a nice spot with the Nets. He's not a great player by any stretch of the imagination and probably wouldn't play on most teams in the league, but he is a good guy to have on your roster.
Yeah, I disagree with you for a little bit. I think like I'd like to see like 15 more games of this. But if he can keep this up, I think he could be a role player even on like a pretty decent team. He's doing like a pretty solid Kyle Korver impersonation so far. And he's not like it's way too early to put him even in the same breath as that guy. But that's kind of like the feeling I get watching him. And you talked about how he sprints around those screens. That's what made Korver so good. The year he was an all-star, he was just running guys ragged all over the court. And I think someone like Alan Crabb could, who again, all props to him, he played pretty well this game, but he could take a note on that. And Josh, I'm forced to ask this again. Is Joe Harris better than Alan Crabb?
I feel like we get into this every other podcast.
It's important.
I think that Alan Crabb is a much more talented player. And right now, Joe Harris is better at his role. And I think Alan Crabb is still struggling to adjust to the expectations of... Because last year when he was in Portland, he had the big contract. But the Nets were the ones that initially offered that contract to him. And Portland was kind of forced into matching. But I felt like he didn't have that pressure because he was still the third guard, or even fourth guard, because Evan Turner got that huge deal behind all those great players in Portland. But now he's expected to be one of the top guys in Brooklyn. He's still struggling to adjust to that expectation of him. So I think that he, over the course of the season, I get on Crabb a lot, but I think he's going to prove to be a much better player than Joe Harris. And I think we saw that last night when Crabb did a really good job of taking it to the basket, not just settling for threes, using that advantage to kind of get to the rim and find some good looks from mid-range. And he had a really good night last night.
Yeah, he was good.
Coming up next on the Locked On Nets podcast, we break down the Nets' big win over the Utah Jazz, get a little bit of momentum there, talk about Raul Neto a little bit, and finally, what grinds Josh's gears?
Let's move on to that Jazz game. The Nets getting a big 118-107 win. They were up by, I think, as many as like about like 16 in the first half. They ripped off like a 14-0 run at one point. Looked really, really good, especially I know the Jazz got to 107, but there were stretches where they were just shutting them down on defense. And obviously offensively, it was another game where the word I kept writing down, and I think you used this earlier too, Josh, was juice. It just seemed like everyone had so much more energy and was so much more engaged than they've been. And I don't want to put this all on D'Lo because it's on guys to get themselves to that level. But it's been completely different than I think the previous like 6, 7, 8 games where they just look like a new team and just totally motivated. And I think all that starts with Spencer Dinwiddie, who was frankly incredible. 9 of 14 from the field, 6 of 10 from 3, 25 and 8 in only 31 minutes. It's a stretch to say he's looking like a star, but he's looking like a very good NBA player. I'll say that much.
Mm-hmm. Dinwiddie for most improved?
Yeah, he's in the mid. You know, especially if D'Lo's out for a long time, like think about it. If he averages like 17 and 6 the whole year, like he's right in the mix.
Yeah, he's averaging 5.6 assists per game and only one turnover per game.
It's amazing.
That's incredible. Yeah. He really does a good job of taking care of the ball, and he's also making difficult passes. He's really running the pick and roll efficiently, and I think for being able to make those passes to set your teammates up to score while not really turning the ball over a lot is such a huge thing for this team, especially when you compare him to guys like Caris LeVert, Isaiah Whitehead, who can't really go 2 minutes on the court without having a bad turnover. It's really a stark contrast.
Yeah, absolutely. No, he's just so smart. And I've said this before on the podcast, but I fell in love with him in summer league, and he actually like reminds me of like how one of our friend Marcus plays, who we always talk about on the show. I think a little bit too much is getting to his head a little bit, but yeah, he's just like, he's smart, he's crafty, he's good at getting to the rim. Like anytime he has like even the slightest edge, he gets there. And I think the biggest thing for me is that like he's totally fearless.
Yeah, first of all, I'm going to have intern Alvin edit out all the Marcus parts of the podcast from now on.
Yeah, that's a good call.
But all, yeah, Dinwiddie, as soon as he sees his defender off balance even a little bit, he will try to blow past him to draw a foul or to get all the way to the basket. I think that's something LeVert could really take a note with, because LeVert, for me, he'll just has so many different dribble moves, and he'll go and he'll pull it back if he doesn't have a complete blow by on a player. And he needs to learn that if he even has a step on his guy, this isn't college, this isn't high school, this isn't even the D League. You have to take advantage of every seam you have, and if you have even any sort of advantage over your defender, you have to take that, because you can get fouled or get to the basket. And he's too hesitant. He needs to make the perfect play every time. And I think that with all these dribble combination moves, it's like a player, it's like someone in 2K. Like, that's how I would control someone. And it really needs to work on being more assertive, because he definitely has the talent, and especially without D'Lo, he needs to be a more consistent force, especially scoring the basketball.
Yeah, he took, I want to say, maybe like a baby step in the right direction in that Jazz game after shooting pretty well against the Celtics. He was 4 of 11 from the field, but you talk about him being assertive. He did put up the third most shots on the team, scored 10 points at the highest plus minus of anyone, and you could argue that was kind of coincidental. But he made a few nice plays over these last two games. There's one in transition where Allen hit him on a go. It was actually a really nice pass by Jared Allen. He threw like 50 feet through the air, and LeVert almost had like, it was like a mini Giannis play where like he caught it at like the three-point line, took one dribble, stopped at the elbow, two steps, and then finished on like the opposite block, and it was just like really athletic and crafty. Had another one where he bounced into a guy, put a layup up and in. And I know it's not enough for your liking, and it's not really enough for my liking, but I think maybe he's slowly starting to get that a little bit.
Well, his three-point shot, I do have to say, did look better. Actually, his follow-through looked more crisp, and that's always been a big problem I have with him. But there were two plays back-to-back where he drove to the basket, and then he was like kind of fading away, and I just bailed the refs out from giving him a foul call, and one he airballed and the other he came up way short on also. And he needs to, when he's attacking the basket, I know maybe he's scared because he doesn't have the frame, and he doesn't want to get injured because he's had some injury problems in the past, but it seems like he doesn't get to the line that much because he doesn't like initiate contact really. I'm not saying to like throw elbows, but you also have to put yourself in a situation that the ref can make a call. You can't bail them out like that.
No, I agree with you. And on that train of thought, I think Alan Crabb is finally starting to do a little bit more of that. And I don't know if it's just Atkinson really getting in his ear, or if he just like naturally realized, like, you know what, I really have to step up with D'Lo out. But he was getting to the rim. He went 7 of 14 from the field. Only 3 of those were threes. Well, no, I was just saying like 3 of the makes were threes. Yeah. But for people who look at that and be like, okay, he seems like a three-point shooter with like a normal shot distribution, that is not what Alan Crabb has been doing all season. He's basically been on the Quincy AC diet of I'm shooting threes or I'm passing the basketball. And he was actually going to the basket, he was attacking, and he was looking to score. And I think because he's looking to score, and like a lot of times he'll drive looking to pass, and when you drive looking to pass, you'll get rid of the ball, but you're unlikely to get an assist. But when you drive looking to score and you're willing to improv off of that, and you draw guys to you, and then you make that kick out, that's when you make productive passes. And I think that's what he was doing more this game. And he only finished with 3 assists, but I counted like 5-6 times where he made really smart passes, and that just kept the machine moving. And that's what we haven't seen enough of from the Nets since the first few games of the season. And the fact that Alan Crabb is participating in that, I think, is a really good sign for his future with this team.
Yeah, I agree with your take on Crabb. He also had one really nice defensive play on Donovan Mitchell where he kind of stymied one of his drives to the basket. You mentioned Quincy AC. Can I just talk about how bad his floor game is?
Sure.
Like, when he drives to the basket, he's so out of control. His passes are horrendous. One, in the first quarter, he had a lazy pass to LeVert, which was deflected off LeVert for a turnover. And then another time, he had Harris wide open, next pass, It was going to be a wide open three, and he just throws it at his feet. And when Terrace catches it and picks it back up, he was off out of rhythm. So AC just frustrates me to no end with his constant mental mistakes. And I think Zeller has actually been solid. Yeah. So I'd like to see AC being phased out of the rotation, play Zeller and Allen as kind of the centers, and then Booker would take over more power forward minutes.
Yeah. I'll throw this out there in defense of AC, and I don't know if he was told to do this.
An amazing drive, to be honest.
Yeah, that was nice, but I wasn't even referencing that. He went after every single loose ball. Like every time the Nets missed, the possession would end with someone getting a rebound and AC either swiping at it or tipping it out of bounds. And like he only like got the ball back for the Nets maybe five or six times, but his hustle was like, I congratulate him on it. That's like how I love guys playing basketball. And sometimes it's counterproductive if you stay down there and you go for a ball you can't get and it leads to a fast break on the other end. But for the most part, I think it kind of set the tone for everyone, and I think it was good.
Yeah, I mean, hustle is great, but you want talented players. And yeah. I'm not saying Tyler
Zeller. Not an option on this team.
Yeah, I'm not saying Tyler Zeller is great. I mean, he's the scrub, and he wouldn't be on any other team. But AC just doesn't play within the system, and he did hit a three tonight, but his shot has not been falling the last few games, and it's been frustrating to watch. And I think that he's kind of gotten exposed in a bigger role, and I would like to see Atkinson dial back his minutes if possible. And he can hustle all he wants on the practice court, yeah. But not in the real games.
Sorry, Quincy, you can't run around in the real games. Yeah, I'm generally with you. My thing with Zeller is like I think he was like a good option with D'Lo in there because D'Lo it was so obvious when he was playing with Mozgov, like he just needed a big that was a little bit more creative and a little bit more skillful around the basket, and like Zeller just barely meets that qualification, and it's only because of how bad Mozgov was in that role. But without him in there, I think that's like just a little bit less of the Nets offense, and you kind of question if it's worth everything he gives up on the defensive end playing him more. But you're right. I mean, if AC's not doing anything on either end, then yeah, that's a fair trade-off. I'll say this though, like Trevor Booker playing with Dinwiddie looks really, really good. Those two guys are both really skilled, both really smart, and it leads to a lot of production when they share the floor together. Booker in 27 minutes, 7 of 10 from the field, 14 and 5.
Yeah, I mean, I think AC's defense is pretty bad, and I think Zeller just being 7 feet tall kind of does the trick a little bit better. So that's just my take on things. Booker, he was had played with a fire, obviously going against his former team. He's boys with Gobert and Ingles, I know from his Jazz days, so I think it was good to see them kind of going back and forth. Joe Ingles, if you guys didn't listen, did an incredible pod with Zach Lowe. He said that every opposing fan we'll just shout at him saying that he looks like a math teacher.
Yeah. Math teacher!
Yeah, I wish the Nets fans saw that and were just like, supermodel, or like, just, yeah, personal trainer, and he would have been so shook. But
what?
Yeah, he was 5 of 5 from three. He's a good player. I know that the Nets were kind of linked to him this offseason, but it seemed like there was no doubt he was going to stay in Utah. And a lot of people question the money he makes, but he really does make the Jazz better anytime he's on the floor.
Yeah, big hockey assist guy. He just makes a lot of smart passes.
Yeah, you can tell that we're trying to get the raise from David Locke with this segment.
Oh yeah, not even subtle about it. Yeah, the Jazz just the best team the Nets have played all year. Anyways, other notes from that game, just kind of like a macro team-wide thing I noticed as kind of a substitute for not having a lot of speed or, I guess, individual creativity, at least in terms of like ball handling and getting to the basket. The Nets kind of substituted that by using like a lot of ball fakes, and they'd been doing this anyways, but I noticed it a lot more over these last two games. Like every time someone was running out of them, they'd fake their way by, get into the lane, and pass it out. I think that's really, really smart, and eventually teams are going to catch on, and it's only going to work if you're hitting your threes, which fortunately they were the last two games. They shot a ridiculous 17 of 37 against the Jazz, and just a ridiculous percentage on that number of attempts. But yeah, as long as they're hitting their threes, that's an effective way to get to the basket. And frankly, it's the only way they're going to get to the basket with the guys that they're playing right now.
Yeah, no, I mean, they definitely have to kind of take advantage and really not settle for ISOs because they're not going to beat anyone off the dribble. Can we just talk about how good Dinwiddie was? Like, He's our god now. We all pray to Dinwiddie because some of the threes he was hitting were just so ridiculous. He was a guy that was known as more of a driver, not really a shooter at all coming out of Colorado. But last year he hit 38% of his threes. This year I think he's up to 45%. Is that sustainable? Because right now I am so high on Spencer Dinwiddie's supply right now.
Yeah, I don't know, just because he's going to like – that guy, like, for not one second in his NBA life has he ever been the focus of a defense's game plan. And that's going to change after the last 2 weeks. He had 11 assists against the Celtics. We told you how good he was shooting the basketball against the Jazz. I think the three-point shooting itself is somewhat sustainable. I don't think 45% is going to happen. I think he looks like a 40% three-point shooter to me. The Nets have like this great segment. I think it was I think it might have been during the first Jazz game where they were showing these videos of Dinwiddie working out as like a kid, and when he was like 10, 12, and he's doing push-ups and he's doing like all these different leg exercises with weights on him and doing like a lot of form shooting. And
I know the guy's a baby face. I think he was like 16, 17.
Oh really? He looked like a 9-year-old. But yeah,
he should not be taught. If anyone's seen a picture of Gavin, he is you can Google some YouTube videos of him with his Super Bowl predictions.
Oh no.
But he looks like he's 7 when he was 15.
Yeah, I was 16 and 17 in those videos. That's fair. I can't talk, but it takes one to know one, Josh.
I'm the opposite because we were at our friend. Ugh, I hate that we're mentioning him again. Marcus.
No,
we're at his mom's party, and
recorded the last episode.
Someone said I looked 40, and I'm like, well, I'm 22. So
yeah. You do have a little bit of salt and pepper hair going. I think it's a good look. It's good for someone in finance. I think it's going to earn you more respect at an early point in your career. Anyways, off of that, Dinwiddie, he's been brilliant. And I think like my point talking about all those exercises is you can see so clearly how they've paid off because he's such a good base. And I think you said something about it earlier. Like even when he's on the move and he catches it like running, like his ability to like set in midair. And remember, like, and I think this is like a big like pet peeve of mine when like broadcasters are always like, you got to have your feet set. You got to have your feet set. And that's important. What really matters is where your shoulders are facing where you shoot. And Dinwiddie's ability to square himself up to the basket in midair is like, I don't want to say like, it's definitely unparalleled on this team. Like maybe Joe Harris is the only guy like in his class, but he just is naturally a really good shooter. And I think he really reaffirmed that on my mind with the buzzer beater he had right before halftime where he hit that shot just past half court. And some guys you can like, I think Steph is the all-time example of this. You can just see how powerful their follow through is. And he just got so much snap on the ball. And that shot was all follow through from 35 feet out. And it was just nylon.
Right. Yeah, no, I agree. I think Steph is obviously the best at it. Don't ask me why, but before you came over, I was watching the Davidson's run to the Elite Eight.
Why?
In 2008. I don't know. I was on a YouTube deep dive. Yeah. And I was watching Steph's kind of like, even from a young age, even in college, his ability to follow through was absolutely incredible. And seeing guys like Dinwiddie and Harris have very good footwork, obviously not going to be able to compare to that, but in the same realm is very important and big for their development as shooters.
Yeah, I absolutely agree with you. If you want to go down that particular rabbit hole, may I recommend Oklahoma Davidson in like 2009, where him and Blake both scored like 40? That's on YouTube, and it is just a joy to watch. That's most of what we had on the Jazz game. Josh, any final thoughts?
I mean, it's great to see the team get a big win. If there's any way we can trade for Raul Neto, because he killed us, and he seems like a decent player, to be honest. He's always kind of gotten buried behind, I guess, last year, George Hill, and then also Exum has been in the fold, and Rubio now. He's always kind of there to play 10 minutes a game, but he's never really gotten a bigger chance. But he's someone that I honestly would like to see the Nets take a chance on. If there's any, I don't think Utah would give him up, really, and what do the Nets have to offer, even? So yeah. That might be unlikely, but he's a guy that seems like he knows how to play, and he has a good feel for in terms of making threes. He can get to the basket when he has a step, makes the right pass, and that's the kind of guy that will fit in Kenny Atkinson's system because he doesn't take anything away from the table.
Josh, how would you feel about trading him for a 2020 first-round pick, 2021 swap, 2022 first-round pick?
I would probably have to do it, but yeah. Maybe throw in Nate Walters and I'll probably do it.
Yeah, two final notes on him now that you're looking him up. I love that his name is Raulzinho Neto. Legally, he's from Brazil, I believe.
Yeah. Is he like a Brazilian soccer? Like, why can't he just be called Neto? Nene. Like, Nene used to have a last name and now he doesn't.
All right, I'd love if everyone had to call him Raulzinho. Yeah, that'd be great. Yeah. But could you imagine the joy Ian Eagle would have in that? Raulzinho with the bucket. Anyways, speaking of Ian Eagle and speaking of Raul Neto, I normally do Ian Eagle's highlight from the game. Today, I had a very obvious low light when Neto sunk a shot. He said the now infamous phrase, Neto, all Neto, as a kind of off-putting for me.
Yeah, I mean, he usually does better, but
I'll say
he has to do with what he had, that's what he had to work with. Yeah. It's off the cuff. He can't always be great.
He swings like he hits like 800 and like, but like some of the misses are like he sells everything so well. So even like the misses aren't that bad. You just kind of like laugh along with him and like they're just like a little bit cringy. But it, like the highs are so good. They are always worth it. And I will say him and Sarah Kustak going back and forth on rock climbing. I take notes as I do throughout every game. And this was my longest note. Just them going back. First Kustak was asking him. And I like that's probably my, or at least like, one of my favorite things about Sarah Kustak as a color commentator, how she'll like quiz Ian and like he clearly wants to talk about anything other than himself for a good chunk of the time. Asking him if he ever had, I think it was if he ever like shaved his head in lieu of Trevor Booker shaving his head. And he said no, he did have long hair at one point. And they were talking about climbing mountains. And he said, quote, nobody's putting a rope around me. And then he said, I'm anti-repellent. And he finally admitted that he went rock climbing once on a wall, but it was, quote, against his will.
Why do you not take notes on your computer? I see you have a notebook. And it's kind of
I almost always. I'll answer that. This was literally the first time I took notes in a notebook, which for anyone, which would only be you out of people listening to this podcast who knows my handwriting, is probably not a good idea because I can barely decipher it. And this is after 4 years of college where like I essentially never wrote anything down. So it's almost unreadable at this point. But I found when I took notes on my computer, I'd inevitably just end up reading articles on my computer during the game, and I didn't feel like I was doing our listeners justice. So I locked in, just me, the notepad, the TV, one screen experience, and it was a joy.
If you haven't had a chance yet, just a reminder to leave a 5-star rating and review for the Locked On Podcast Network. Remember, it's irrelevant if you like the podcast. Just give us 5 stars, and we are all good.
What grinded your gears?
Yeah, I'm going to run it back. So the Celtics have a 14-game winning streak. They beat the Warriors, which is slightly more prestigious than a win against the Nets. And I just had to stay off Twitter. All of the national media guys that I follow, Kevin O'Connor, Chris Mannix, Bill Simmons, Jeff Goodman, they all have the Boston slant, and it's so annoying after they do anything well. And the last 10 years, they've been a great sports town. I'm a Yankees fan, so it's been especially painful to see the Red Sox do well. And obviously with the Celtics having the Nets pick, it just rubs salt in the wounds. So the Boston media guys are just so biased. I cannot hear anything about Jason Tatum being the next KD, LeBron mashup. It's insufferable to me. Bill Simmons in his column this week listed Shane Larkin, former net great Shane Larkin, as one of the big winners in having a resurgence this year. And he's averaging 3 points per game and shooting 28% from the field. And Gavin knows that I am a troll when it comes to other people's sports teams. Gavin, how much do I hate the Knicks, and how much do I troll Knicks fans?
I don't think you actually like hate them that much. I think you just really just try and get under my skin and like all of our other friends' skin who are Knicks fans, and you succeed pretty well. There's been a lot of Kristaps comments that have been borderline worthy of severing the friendship. I'll say that.
Right. Okay. That's fine. But I'm a big Knicks hater. I think I'll admit it myself. But just the Celtics and their whole paparazzi that follows them is so insufferable to me. And Brad Stevens is one of the best coaches in the league, probably top two. And his ability to take all this collection of role players, even guys like Kyrie, who are star-level talents, but just elevate them to superstars is remarkable. But I cannot read my Twitter timeline and see just the gushing and the people just slobbing the knobs of all the Celtics role players with no talent.
Yeah. No, I can't disagree with you. I think this year they're actually like a pretty likable team just because Kyrie's so fun, and then it's just like all the young guys, and I know like I really enjoyed watching them. But yeah, you're right. It's not worth like the Twitter reactions and like the people like they're like Celtics fans want to rub it in your face, like how well run they are.
It's like I saw all the last 2 years of Yabusele was going to be like the greatest player of all time, and now he doesn't play. And I'm sure they're going to forget about him. But when he does play like 5 minutes and scores 1 point, they'll freak out.
Yeah, I'll say this. Like, I thought the Celtics fans were – and like the Celtics pundits were better than their Warriors equivalents, because I think the Warriors are like – and I think most people who aren't fans of them would agree with this – are like the worst at that. But this season, the Celtics, now that they're really, really good, they're approaching that territory.
Yeah, I mean, I'm still going to – I still think that the Cavs would beat them in a series. That's just something that's – with LeBron, you can't doubt him until he misses the finals for that first time in 7 years, I guess. I will pick him to make the finals every time, regardless of having Derrick Rose and Dwayne Wade and Channing Frye around him. I still believe in him. But obviously, the Celtics are a very well-coached team. And if Hayward can come back in April and look somewhat decent, even just like a contributing role player, they're going to be a dangerous team. And obviously they have a bright future. So it's, I hate them because they are good. So
Yeah, absolutely. And you always want to hate greatness. Yeah, that is about it for the Locked On Nets podcast. Josh, final thought?
Yeah. Okay, so the Nets are playing the Warriors tomorrow. What are your predictions for that game?
Well, again, we probably, I think like it's always pretty uncouth to talk about live scores during a podcast, but I guess it gives a good time capsule where I'm at mentally right now. So as of this talking, the 76ers lead the Golden State Warriors by 15. They were up by like 22 earlier. They might go on to lose the game because they're a young team and the Warriors are incredible. But assuming the Sixers hold on and win, I think the Warriors are going to unleash holy hell on the Nets tomorrow.
That's possible. Listen, if you think this game might be a blowout and doesn't mean anything and you're down on yourself because the Nets franchise has a tough outlook right now and the Warriors are the Warriors, don't feel discouraged. There was a game 2 years ago, I think, the year that the Warriors won 73 games, and this was maybe – they were 10-0 to start the year. And the Nets, if you recall, were tied with them at the end of regulation. Brook Lopez misses the easiest shot that would have won the game, and I think that's one of the most underrated what-ifs in NBA history. Because if he makes that, the Warriors stop their streak. They don't go for 24 to start the year, and they don't win 73 games and push their players. So maybe they win the championship that year with more rested players. Maybe KD doesn't come there. Maybe Melo's still on the Knicks. Maybe Paul George is in Cleveland instead of the Thunder. If all this happens in this alternate timeline, You know what? This just means that anything can happen. This is an important game, and I'm excited to watch the Warriors play and see. If Dinwiddie, if I'm excited to see him drop 50 on the Warriors.
Yeah, all I'm hearing is you're thinking this is going to start a 27 game win streak for the Nets.
Yeah, like 20, 22. Okay. I wouldn't go 27 because once you get to that 20, it's really hard to keep climbing that mountain.
Yeah, and at that point, Rondé might not score 30 for the first time in 10 games. Anyways, for Josh, that was a powerful way to end the podcast. I didn't know you had that at all. I think you might have mentioned that theory to me before, but I don't remember it. So that was good. That was good. For Josh, I am Gavin. We will be back. I'm going to say we'll record one. What time do they play tomorrow? Is it an afternoon game? Because then we could record one tomorrow.
They are playing at 6, so we could very possibly be giving you a live react to the Nets win over the Warriors.
Okay, so either that, if not, that should come out on Tuesday, because I'm lucky enough to go work with our boss, David, on Monday on that Jazz broadcast, helping him out with some stats. So I'll be in Philadelphia. And then, worst case scenario, we'll knock it out on Tuesday, get it to you Tuesday night. For Josh, I'm Gavin. Peace out.